Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Peter Jørgenfors about his book, The Geometry of Meaning. His book outlines and develops a novel approach to semantics, founded in the idea of conceptual spaces, and discusses how linguistic meanings can be rooted in these spaces. In this interview, we talk about the essence of the theory and the nature of conceptual spaces, and we discuss some of its potential implications, not only for linguistics, but also for cognitive science, developmental research, and even human-computer interaction. I'm delighted to welcome Peter Jørgenfors to talk about his new book, The Geometry of Meaning, in which he proposes a theory of semantics rooted in conceptual spaces. Peter, you've published extensively on a huge range of topics, both within and beyond cognitive science. What draws you to the subject of this work?
I have always had an interest in different ways of representing knowledge. I started with an interest in logic, and then I turned to different kinds of epistemology. I was a philosopher for many years before I became a cognitive scientist. And then I started to become interested in using geometry as a general method of modeling meanings, semantic representations in particular, but also in terms of reasoning and other things related to that.
It's definitely my impression that the mathematical content of this proposal is quite fundamental to your account. Do you feel drawn to an approach that has that kind of rigor about it?
I mean, I have a background in mathematics, and I like putting some kind of formal rigor to my writing. So, I mean, the book is not very mathematical, but I presume that you're familiar with some basic concepts of geometry, like a set being convex and things like that. It should be easy, accessible, even if you don't have a very deep background in mathematics. But that's part of my program. I mean, to give it a rigor that, in principle, in the long run, could turn this kind of semantics into some kind of computational implementation.
I mean, it strikes me as interesting because a lot of work in this area, or it's my impression that a lot of work in this area uses mathematical analogies or uses, if you like, a metaphorical appeal to language, but this is going rather deeper than that, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I have this idea of using conceptual spaces, and the idea of a space I take rather literally, that this they are built up from different kinds of dimensions, and then I perform various kinds of mathematical operations on these spaces in order to represent various aspects of meanings of words in natural language.
Generally, it seems that your approach or conception of semantics breaks from, if you like, the linguistic tradition in several particulars. What would you consider to be the most fundamental way in which it's a departure from that line?
I mean, I'm not a linguist, really. I mean, I have studied a bit of linguistics, but I think of myself as a semanticist. I mean, I'm interested in the semantics of language, the meaning of communication. And that is not only language, but also gestures and other forms of communication. And I think there is some kind of structure to how our minds represent meanings. And that these structures that I want to represent by conceptual spaces. And that means that the language as such is not what comes first in my approach, but it's these semantic structures. And then I want to show that these structures can be used to model different aspects of semantics. In particular, in this book, I try to explain why we have different word classes. I mean, in traditional linguistics, word classes are described in terms of their syntactic features. I try to give a description that is totally free of syntax and instead do it in terms of conceptual spaces.
And it's interesting that you position the work in that way. I remember talking to a linguistic semanticist and asking whether she considered semantics to be, if you like, a proper part of linguistics, or whether she'd embrace a more broad definition that took a lot of it, if you like, outside the domain of what has been treated in linguistics in recent years. You would, I think, embrace a fairly holistic conception of semantics, wouldn't you?
Yes, I do. I mean, unlike the Chomskyan tradition, where the main interest is in whether a sentence is grammatical or not, I start with communication as the basic element. I mean, we communicate in different ways, with or without words, and then we conventionalize our communication. We develop words and phrases that have particular meanings, and then we, in order to be more precise, we add syntactic markers to be able to communicate with further precision. So I would view the three parts of language in the opposite order to what is normal within the Chomskyan tradition.
What are the implications for that in your view? What are the, if you like, misperceptions about the way in which semantics should be analysed that we might fall into by going about it the linguistic way, the syntax first way?
But to put it very tersely, meaning comes before syntax. So we have these meaning representations in our heads even before we start communicating about them. And I mean, as children, of course, there is an interplay between language and meanings, but we have our perceptual systems, we have our memory systems, and we have our ways of thinking. And these systems, they put constraints on how meanings can be constructed. And then we add language as a way of expressing these meanings. And so for me, language is it's a tool for communicating about the meanings we already have.
So you feel that the traditional approach is in some sense too inward-looking, would you say, or is that too strong?
In general, I would say that language has been separated from perception. I mean, there are exceptions within cognitive semantics and so on. But my focus is on the meanings. And then the second question is, how can we express these meanings?
So taking the cognitive line, I mean, follow Langacker, 1987, in placing the notion of cognitive domain at the heart of your program, but you discuss these in a slightly different way to how he puts them. What are domains in your theory?
I mean, I borrowed the notion of a domain from Langacker, that's true, although he doesn't give it a very formal treatment. I mean, he introduces that as a kind of primitive phenomenon. For me, they are really the central building blocks. I mean, for me, domains are bundles of dimensions. And to give my favorite example, you take the color domain. I mean, we know that our perception of colors come in three dimensions, and these three dimensions have a certain structure. So for me, the color domain is one domain. And then we can talk about size, we can talk about shape, we can talk about temperature, and we can also talk about more abstract domains like kinship or money or and so on. So my basic assumption is that meaning can be divided into a set of domains. It's an open-ended set of domains, since we learn more and more as we grow up, as we learn more and more about our world around us and so on. But still, meanings are structured in terms of these domains.
Do you take a view on what constitutes a mental representation of these domains, or maybe even a neural representation of those domains?
Well, now we are entering very difficult philosophical ground here. And I mean, of course, I think that there is some kind of mental representation. What I propose is more or less a model of how our thinking about meanings can be represented. Then the question of how this is realized in our brains and how it's grounded in different other substructures, I leave that more or less open. So this is a semi-mathematical model that I use to represent meanings. And to what extent they really correspond to our mental structures, I leave partly open.
Sure, yeah. A big sort of recurring feature of the linguistic treatment of your book is that it's the idea that you emphasize the single domain thesis.
Yes.
You ultimately state a general version of this, which is that words in all content word classes except for nouns refer to a single domain. What's the status of that claim for you?
Well, in a sense, I think that's the main novelty in my book, that I think I've discovered that most words have meanings in one domain only. And then there are, of course, metaphorical extensions in all directions. But and the status of this claim is, well, in a mild form, I would say it's a rule of thumb, something that constrains meanings of words and that children can piggyback on when they learn a language. I mean, if they hear a new word, if they can identify it as an adjective or as a verb, then they can use that when learning what is the meaning of the word. So, for instance, if they have learned one adjective like cold, and then they learn to know something about the domain of temperature, and very soon they can learn. Then they can then learn the meaning of warm. I mean, I've noticed that the opposites, the antonyms in language, are learned at about the same time when children pick up new words, and that's some kind of support that we learn. We don't learn single words; we learn words in different domains, but. The rule of thumb assumption is a weak one. A stronger claim would be to say that all words except for nouns, really have a foundational meaning in one domain only. I'm not sure to what extent I could support that hypothesis. I mean, in the book, I discuss a number of potential counterexamples to the thesis, but I still hope that this thesis will be a kind of provocation for linguists, so that they can go on and test the validity of this idea.
Indeed, yes. I mean, one issue about the testability might be that if anything can in principle be a domain, we could always posit a new domain and save, so to speak, the single domain thesis. But presumably that wouldn't be desirable. You'd want to impose some kind of a priori limitation on what can constitute a domain.
That's a very good question. I mean, and that's really a problem I have in the book. I mean, I introduce this notion of a domain, and I give examples, mainly examples from the perceptual domains and embodied structures and so on. But of course, you need a fairly precise definition of what constitutes a domain in order to make the thesis really testable. And when it comes to some of the perceptual domains, I think I'm on pretty firm ground. For instance, the color domain and some other domains like that. But when it comes to the more abstract domains, I mean, I don't know really how to delimit the boundaries between the domain and how to identify them. So at the moment, I must see the thesis, the single domain thesis, as a kind of research program. I mean, I can show that it's valid for some of the domains, and I hope that we can work out a theory of more abstract domain so that the theory can be tested in other aspects.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, presumably there's also a distinction between those domains, some of which, as you say, are very primitive and founded in perceptual experience, and in that sense we could be considered to have innate knowledge of them, which constrains our hypotheses about the meanings of words. But then other domains are going to be much more complex and built based on experience and constitute in some way a means of organizing that experience. Would that be a fair assessment?
That would be a very fair assessment, except that I wouldn't claim that very many domains are innate. I mean, we learn them as we develop our perception of the world. I mean, we learn to distinguish different kinds of shapes. We learn to experience temperature and weight and all these basic perceptual domains. But of course, they come very naturally if you're a human with a fairly normal upbringing. And so they form a kind of foundation where language meanings can get their foothold, so to speak. Then, of course, when we come to cultural dimensions, I mean, kinship relation is one example. Of course, there are basic biological structures in kinship, but there are also all kinds of social structures on top of that. And there are other cultural domains where, I mean, like how we organize our societies and cultural phenomena that I don't know how to analyze. I don't know exactly if I can put these domains into some kind of geometrical structure. But that's a hope, and that's for me and for other people to work further on.
Yes, I mean, as you mentioned, the mathematical conception of the model is rooted on this assumption that we would be able to discern in principle the geometric structure for domains. But as you note, except in those for which we have psychophysical evidence, those rather low-level domains that are based largely on perceptual experience, it seems to be quite difficult to put that together. Could you sketch out how we might come to an understanding of the geometry of a complex domain like kinship?
Yeah, there are. I can think of two basic methods. One is, of course, to work like the psychophysicists do. That is, to start with a number of similarity judgments. I mean, you find that orange is more similar to red than orange is to blue, so orange is closer in color space to red. So we, on the basis of such similarity judgments, there are methods for generating the geometrical structures, the domains that I'm working with. But of course, psychophysics doesn't work for all types of domains. So another method would actually be to look at the metaphors we use, because the metaphors reveal the structure of the target domain, the domain we are talking about. And the source domain, then, if we know the structure of the source domain, we can transfer that to the structure of the target domain. And in that way, by looking at what metaphors we use, we can see something about how we conceive of more abstract domains.
Just to go back to those sort of perceptual domains, the ones studied by psychophysics, is it your view that there is a process of organizing this input, so to speak, into this sort of structured notion of domain, or is that something that we, if you will, do automatically?
For some of the basic domains, I think we do it automatically. But then there are various layers we put on top of that. I mean, there are these phenomena of that are called categorical perception. I mean, we learn an alphabet, we learn a series of numbers, and when we see a pattern, we interpret it as a particular item of the alphabet because we have these categories in our minds already, so to speak, and then we organize our perception according to them. So categorical perception is one way to have a kind of top-down influence from our mental representations to how we organize the world.
I'd like to turn, if I may, to another theme that runs through the book, which is the notion of meetings of minds.
Yes.
Which is so fundamental to your conception of semantics. Could you describe the implications of that?
In traditional semantics, I mean, in analytic philosophy and in a lot of the early formal semantics in linguistics, it was seen as a mapping between some kind of linguistic structure, a formal language in the ideal case, and a world or several possible worlds in modal logic. So the language was some kind of a relation between words and the world. But then came cognitive linguistics and said that no, meanings are in the head of the individuals. We live with image schemas, and it's the image schema that determine the meaning of the words. However, a hidden assumption in cognitive linguistics is that these image schemas are more or less identical or very similar between individuals. We know that there are lots of cases where people think of the meanings of words in different ways. So the question is, how can we be sure that we talk about the same thing? I mean, even if I have one picture of a word, like, say, the word insect in my mind, and you have another picture, I mean, you may think of spiders as being insects, while for me, spiders is a totally different category than insects. Then I'm not sure whether we talk about the same thing when we use the word insect. So I need a principled way of bringing in the interaction between language users. So meaning, in my opinion, is generated by the communicative interactions between speakers. So this is why I talk about meetings of mind. Now the question is, of course, how can we model this kind of meeting of minds? And then I, together with my collaborator Massimo Vaglian in Venice, we have developed a model that is based on some kind of fixed point theorem. This is like the language games that were studied by David Lewis and Bob Stolnacker, except that we add the geometrical structure to these language games. So we can really talk about equilibria or fixed points in communicative games. And we can talk about the geometrical structures of these fixed points. So we have some kind of mathematical model of how this meeting of mind can be established in a communication game. Now, developing this theory into full-blown semantic theory is a very big task. And I've only made the very first steps in my book. But I think I have outlined a possible solution to bringing in the social aspect of language in a more or less formal model of how communication about meanings would be possible.
As to the formality of the model, as you mentioned, this is rooted in or inspired by mathematical fixed point theorem, to quote Breuer's theorem in the book. What I wasn't quite clear as to whether the whether the proposal, if you like, relied upon the mathematics of that, or was in some sense relying on an approximation to the mathematics of that, or was speaking in some sense slightly metaphorically about the analogy.
And the analogy is that this fixed point theorem is a kind of existence result. It shows that under very broad circumstances, people who start with different ways of using words, if they want to be successful in communication, they have to adapt their meaning spaces. And in ideal end, they will end up with a kind of fixed point of meaning. I mean, this is, you can rephrase this modeling in terms of game theory. We did it in terms of this kind of fixed point modeling, but the principle would be the same, except that we use the geometrical structures of meaning quite a lot in this result. I mean, the notion of convexity of meaning is very central for this fixed point result. So it's an idealization, but it shows that the point is that under very general conditions, people can adjust their meanings and agree on meanings via iterated communication.
Yeah, I mean, as you discuss, it is an idealization, but it's an idealization you think is somewhat reasonable, that the or at least by appeal to other results, we can assume that there's some approximation to this idealization that's somewhat stable. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, as I said, this result is an existence result. It doesn't say very much about the process of how we reach the fixed point. And that requires a quite different study. I mean, I refer to some game simulations where people have tried to show how these fixed points are established, and so we can show that also in simulations we can reach these communicative fixed points. But I mean, to do an analysis of how it happens in an actual natural language would be very complicated.
So you would approve of appealing to the kind of work that's been done on relatively small scale or relatively constrained communication games and so on?
Yes. I mean, there are experimental games, but they are rather constrained in the number of expressions used and in the possibility of changing the meanings.
If this is a sensible question, I'm not sure it is. What is it that drives us towards a fixed point? How is it that we arrive at an understanding we need to adjust our categorization in order to communicate successfully?
Well, I'm also interested in the evolution of language. And for me, a very strong driving force behind our use of symbolic system is that we have a stronger need to cooperate than other animals have. So we need to cooperate about things that are not present. We need to cooperate about future goals and things like that. And that means we need some kind of system that refers to entities that are not present. And a way or doing that, we can do it by gestures, we can do it by icons, but we've developed some kind of symbols, the words, to refer to things that are not present. But then, of course, we need some kind of matching. We need to coordinate our meanings so we can be sure that we do the right actions when we want to cooperate tomorrow. I mean, we may make a plan now that may mean that you go one way and I go another way. And if we are not coordinated in where we meet or what we do, then our actions will fail. So ultimately, the coordination comes down to pragmatics, that is success of cooperation. So that's why we need to have a meaning system that is sufficiently, or meaning systems that are sufficiently well adjusted to one another.
Am I right in thinking that this relates to the coordination within an established domain?
Yes, it does. I mean, we have word meanings, and we talk about colors or places or shapes or whatnot. And that's one of my theses, that the words come with the assumption that there is a particular domain we are talking about. And of course, that's the first problem to solve, that to know that we talk about the same domain. But I don't think that's the normal problem. The normal problem is to adjust within a domain. So we may have different meaning ways of categorizing colors or shapes or something like that. I mean, you may call something red while I call it violet. And if we don't agree on where is the border, I mean, how to choose between the different colors, we may end up in not finding the right coordination in our plans.
So the assumption would be that we have generally coordination at the crude level of domains, that we share those domains because they're initially rooted in somewhat common perceptual experience.
Yes.
Is that right?
And when we learn in the domain, we normally learn what is called the basic level of the domain, and the basic level of concept. So we learn animal names, and then we learn subcategories. I mean, if we learn dog first, then we learn words like terrier and poodle and so on. So we may agree upon the basic meaning, and we may agree upon what is a dog, but we may not agree upon what is a terrier. I mean, you may be a specialist on dogs and I may not be so knowledgeable. So we have to adjust our meanings of the more specialized words. And I think a lot of communication, a lot of coordination of words is about these kinds of problems.
Turning to the second part of the book, you discuss the analysis of different parts of speech in terms of domains. I mean, here fundamentally it becomes clear that you suspect the means by which we traditionally, within a linguistic framework, identify and define different parts of speech might be wrong. Is that so?
Not directly wrong, but they, I mean, for nouns and adjectives, I think I'm in agreement with most of linguistics. But if you look at work on the semantics of verbs, for instance, people never really leave the linguistic level. I mean, there are analyses of the meaning of the verb break means to cause to become broken, and then they don't analyze what is meant by broken. I mean, you never leave the linguistic level. And I think one of the benefits of my book is that I have a theory of events and of actions. I mean, a cognitive theory of actions and events that underpin the meaning of verbs. So I can somehow formulate the meaning of verbs in terms of vectors, force vectors and change vectors, and that helped me in breaking this circle and getting out of the linguistic descriptions.
Are there categories for which the analysis you propose strikes you as, if you like, more immediately satisfactory than others? I mean, you dwell, for instance, on the case of adverbs, which might be problematic for various reasons.
Adverbs is a very difficult word, Klaus, and I'm not an expert in the area, so I avoided that in the book. But, of course, adjectives work very well in my analysis. I mean, the domains, in particular when it comes to perceptual domains, work very well for adjectives. And I also think that prepositions can be very nicely described in terms of the geometrical structures. Most of them, I mean, one point in the book is that some of the prepositions actually involve forces. But then I have a mathematical theory of the forces that allow me to analyze some prepositions like in and over in terms of force vectors rather than purely spatial structures. So I would say adjectives and prepositions fit very well with the theory. But then I'm also rather optimistic that the theory of verbs that I present in the books can be developed and more fleshed out into a richer theory of different kinds of verb meanings and so on.
In the case of prepositions, you also have this interesting idea, which I don't think I've seen before, that by switching to a polar coordinate system, we might get a better understanding of how the use of a particular preposition is going to be determined. I wonder, could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I was surprised when I started looking at the meaning of prepositions that nobody had really proposed the use of polar coordinates. The polar coordinates mean that you look at the distance between where you are and the point you're referring to and the angle to a landmark or something like that. So the polar coordinates are in terms of distance and angle rather than in width, breadth, and height as in ordinary Euclidean geometry. So I did this work together with Joost Zwarts, a Dutch linguist, and he had studied prepositions along the same lines as I was interested in doing, and he had never really expressed it in terms of polar coordinates. But once we did that, we found a very systematic analysis of a large class of prepositions.
I think it's a very interesting idea. I'm very curious to know how generalizable it is cross-linguistically, which is a point you make elsewhere as well, that there's the matter of testing some of these ideas cross-linguistically. What's the status of that work as far as you're aware?
I mean, as I said, I'm not a linguist, and I don't know. I can't compare very many languages. I've talked to a number of linguists, and my hope is that this kind of analysis that I'm presenting in the book can be extended to other languages than English. So I think that the meaning structures that I'm presenting are really universal. But then how different languages carve up in the different domains, how you carve up color space, for instance, and how they represent the different meanings, that can vary a lot between the languages. But I mean, I think I've pointed out two general principles. That is that concepts correspond to convex regions of a domain, and most words correspond to meanings in a single domain. I mean, I think these constraints should be found in most languages. So this is a hope I have that other researchers, other linguists, will try my ideas on other languages as well.
Yes, absolutely. I should ask about the status of nouns in the model, just because we haven't actually explicitly discussed those here. These are a special case in some sense.
Yeah, in the sense that nouns depend on several domains. When you talk about a color, it's one domain. But when you talk about a dog or a chair or an apple, it has several domains. I mean, a dog has a size, it has a shape, it has a color, it has a smell, it has a sound, it has a weight, it has a temperature. I mean, a noun comes with lots of domains. domains, and it also comes with correlations between the different aspects. I mean, if you have a large dog, it will have a deeper voice, and so on. So a noun is a kind of correlation between different properties. It's a bundle of properties. So in that sense, nouns are different from other word classes, since my thesis is that for the other word classes, there is a single domain that determines the meaning.
In the case of some items, possibly even no domains.
Yeah.
How do you treat, for example, quantifiers in the model?
Quantifiers come out as a rather special category of words. I mean, they have been very popular among formal logicians and some linguists in the Montague tradition, because they've been analyzed in terms of possible worlds and things like that. I don't require anything like possible worlds for my analysis, but the quantifiers come out as some special cases, and they function. Some of them function syntactically like nouns, and it turns out that they have properties, I mean meaning properties, that are like nouns. But on my analysis, quantifiers are classified in a different way than what is normally done within logic. And I mean, this is a very complicated area, and it would be difficult for me to get into details here.
Oh, absolutely. What I'd like to ask now is really, having stated your theory and developed it over the course of this book, what would you like to see being done about it?
Well, personally, I want to continue on the events and the verbs. I mean, I think I've discovered something concerning meanings of verbs that is worth pursuing, and that depends on the model of events. And the model of events that I've developed together with Massimo Vaglian can be extended to a general cognitive theory of events that can be applied to many other areas than just semantics. I mean, we are thinking of developing a theory of causation, and other people are working on that as well, based on this kind of model. So for me, events and verbs is what I want to continue on. But as I said, I also hope that other linguists will take up these ideas and, I mean, test them to the extent they are directly testable, and try them on different languages and see how far you can extend these ideas about words are having meanings in only one domain and words corresponding to regions in domains. And I would really like to have these ideas tested.
As you say, there's quite a strong sort of claim about the way in which language is constituted. But there's also a claim, if you like, outside of linguistics about the organization of the concept system. I mean, is there work to be done also on the cognitive science side of the fence, so to speak? Is there experimental work there that could help elucidate the nature of these?
Of course. There are plenty of work in that area. I mean, one source of motivation for my work was this problem that it's been stated that children cannot learn language because the data is too sparse. And so Chomsky and others have claimed that there must be some kind of innate basis for language. I would like to show that given the constraints given the structures we have on how we organize our perceptions and our memories and so on, it's not at all impossible to learn language. I mean, you just have to learn what are the relevant domains. That's not a simple task in itself, but it's doable. And then once you have the domains, you have to learn which words you can use to express structures in these domains. So I would like to see my theory, I mean, this conceptual spaces, as a source of constraints that our brains are using when we are learning language, and that these constraints somehow help us in explaining how children can learn language as quickly as they can. So there are lots of experiments you can do on how children pick up domains, how they learn words in the domains, and so on. I'm currently involved at my university with some experiments on children learning additive antonym pairs and seeing the developmental structure of this learning.
Yes, you mentioned in particular the classic work showing that children have, as analyzed in terms of this model, confusion in separating domains at an early developmental stage, don't they?
Yeah. This is quite interesting because, for instance, I mean, take Piaget's classical work on conservation. I mean, small children cannot distinguish the height of a liquid in a glass from the volume of it. So they think the higher the lemonade is in the glass, the more there is. But then they learn that there is a correlation between if the glass is wide, then it contains more lemonade. So they learn this principle of volume. They learn to distinguish the dimension of height from the dimension of volume. So that's a development in terms of domains. And I think we can see traces of this in language development. I mean, learning language is very much a question of learning to perceive and understand new domains. So I think that child psychologists and linguists could shake hands in studying the development of domains.
And more broadly, presumably this idea has implications for the nature of what is innate knowledge. That is, you're taking position that we don't need to posit rich innate knowledge that is language specific, but perhaps we do have some kind of set of guiding principles as to how domains are constituted, what they can be, how we posit new ones, and so on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have more or less similar perceptual systems, and the, I don't talk very much about brain structures, but I presume that our ways of handling the perceptual information we get are more or less similar in our brains. That means we have a lot of common cognitive structures that the language learning that can depend on and build on. We have these perceptual mechanisms as a grounding for some language. I mean, that's the bootstrap that we can use. And then on top of that, we learn to use different kinds of abstract domains. In addition to Piaget's distinction between height and volume, you could add Newton's distinction between weight and mass. I mean, normally people don't make a distinction between weight and mass because on normal conditions, I mean, we don't need that. But Newton's theory depended on that distinction. I mean, that's a scientific discovery that introduces a new domain or a new dimension, the mass dimension, that was crucial for the development of Newton's theory. So we find that kind of development also in scientific theories.
In the last section of your book, you discuss some of the implications of this approach for computational systems of language. How helpful do you think this model could be in improving the performance of dialogue systems?
I hope it will be very helpful in the long run. I mean, there is a large distance between the rather abstract models I present and real computer applications. But still, this idea of organizing information in domains should be very helpful to a programmer who wants to run or develop a question answering system, because you can organize all the questions, all the information along the domains, and then you can assign areas of the domains as meanings of the words. And hopefully that will help in developing a question answering system that comes closer to a natural dialogue than most systems that exist now. I know this is a long shot, but still I believe and I hope that the concept of spaces will prove useful for computer programmers and question and answering system and things like that. I mean, in artificial intelligence systems. Then another application would be in robotics, where robots would have to communicate with humans, and they can then perceive the actions of the human, and via my analysis of action, they could perhaps understand a bit of what the human is doing and express itself about that and ask questions in relation to the actions. So this is still far away, but hopefully the structures I presented can be used also to develop new areas within human-robot interaction.
Yes, it's definitely my impression that it would be possible within that area to exploit some of these structures, some of these findings, without necessarily taking a position as to whether the whole was going to be an optimal model of the whole human system, so to speak. I mean, is that
yeah,
fair?
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that if you look at other semantic accounts, I mean, within linguistics, they are not very suitable for implementation. And I wouldn't say that my models go directly into implementation, but they're easier to handle for a programmer than most other linguistic theories are.
Absolutely, yes. I'd like to conclude by asking about your own personal research priorities. I mean, we've discussed over the last three quarters of an hour many of the many of the possible ways in which this theory could be further tested, particularly experimentally. But I'm also conscious that, as I alluded to, you have an enormous portfolio of work and research interests across an enormously wide set of areas. Is it a priority for you to pursue this, or do you have other things calling you away?
I'm a person with many interests, so I find it, I shouldn't say difficult, but I mean, I work in many areas at the same time. But anyway, I want to continue, as I said, on the verb and event parts of it. But I also want to connect this closer to my earlier work on the evolution of language. I want to look at different forms of communication, those forms that are unique to humans. And by analyzing what kind of cognition you need and what kind of communication you need for that form of cooperation, for instance, to plan for future goals or to form a contract or whatever, then I hope to see what is required of language, what kind of linguistic structures are needed, what are the basic structures that we have to have in an early language. So I think that by combining an analysis of cooperation with my semantic theory, I might get some new ideas about or formulate some new constraints on how language evolved.
That sounds like a very interesting outlook. How does this interface with other work you allude to at various points in the book on language evolution?
Well, I also think that in language evolution, we could have a look at what domains do you need to talk about. I mean, in the early days, we couldn't talk about money, we couldn't talk about governments, we couldn't talk about art, we couldn't talk about music. There were lots of domains that were simply not available. But there were, of course, perceptual domains, there were the animals, there were lots of things in the world. So in that sense, early language was constrained to the domains that people had thought about. And by looking at what domains are required for different forms of work, for different forms of cooperation, for different forms of communication, I think we can formulate a new set of constraints on the evolution of language that hasn't been discussed before.
Does the evolution consist just in the emergence or unfolding of new domains, or in the changing or repositioning of existing ones?
I guess there's always been metaphor. I mean, my position is that meanings existed way before there was a language. I mean, we had some form of concepts and some form of maybe communication about concepts in terms of gestures or actions and coordinations of actions. So we had to somehow coordinate our concepts even before we can communicate in words about them. In that sense, I think that semantics comes prior to to syntax. But of course, as soon as we had meanings, we could talk about, we had metaphorical mapping. So I also think that by looking at basic metaphorical structures, we learn a bit about the evolution of language.
Well, I think it's a fascinating program, and I look forward to hearing more about the results in due course.
I'm afraid you will have to wait a couple of years, but anyway, that's what I'm working on at the moment.
That's okay. Everything worth reading takes a long time.
Okay. Thank you.
For the meantime, let me say, Peter Jørdenfors, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
I've been talking to Peter Jørdenfors about The Geometry of Meaning. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language saying thank you for listening.